With so many people coming in and out of the podcast studio, aka my living room, it is important that we keep Tucker smelling good and looking handsome. Thank goodness we discovered Coat Defense's Daily Preventative Powder. It works like a dry shampoo and it eliminates the bacteria that causes odor in the first place. And unlike a typical deodorant or spray, Coat Defense is healthier. It doesn't mask odor, it eliminates it. Tucker's friends at Coat Defense are offering you 15% off to try this Daily Preventative Powder or any of the other awesome products they offer for your pet's health. Just use code MAMA15 at checkout. Able offers thoughtfully designed apparel, denim, shoes, handmade jewelry, and leather bags that you can feel good about wearing. Each piece is manufactured in the communities where Able makes an impact, including neighborhoods right here in Nashville, Tennessee, and around the world. I love that women comprise more than 90% of the staff at Able, and Able has been able to see firsthand how providing women with safe and dignified jobs has the power to change not only their families, but entire communities. Use the code MAMA20 for 20% off your first purchase site-wide when you visit ableclothing.com. We are rewinding to one of my favorite episodes we've ever recorded, and we are doing it just in time for the release of the Unsung Hero movie, which is about the life of our guest, Helen Smallbone. Helen is mother to Joel and Luke from For King and Country and Christian artist Rebecca St. James, and the journey that this family has been on is quite unbelievable. Even if you've never heard of the Smallbone family, I really encourage you to take a listen. It is so full of wisdom and inspiration and will no doubt bless anyone who listens. Enjoy this episode and be sure to go see the movie. It is such a beautiful representation of God's faithfulness. Helen, thank you so much for being here. I am just days away from having finished your book, and I was just so inspired by hearing your story. And I have known from covering Christian music for so many years, I've always heard a little bit about the journey and how, you know, the boys were working behind the scenes for Rebecca's career and all of that. But to actually really get an insider's perspective from my favorite perspective, a mother, I especially love that. So thank you for being here and sharing even more of your story.
Pleasure, Jennifer. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. So you actually grew up as a pastor's child. So you have been a part of the faith community from the time you were born.
In actual fact, I think I was challenged by it when I got into my teens, for the fact that I never knew anything else. You know, like you get then people who are giving their lives to Jesus and they're having this radical life change. And I'm sitting back there thinking, gosh, I don't even know if I've got a testimony. Like I don't, I mean, I've never known anything different than sort of following God and being in church and being in a faith community. And obviously, I had to own my own faith, and I think that's probably a challenge for young people who grow up in a Christian home, that at some point they have to make a decision, this is going to be my faith, it's not a generational faith, I've got to make this choice for me. I think my dad understood that, and I actually became a Christian at 14. I had an encounter with the Holy Spirit at 16, a little bit like what we've seen in the Asbury revival, where we actually had the Holy Spirit, not quite as dramatic as that, but we had the Holy Spirit fall on our youth group, and we saw dramatic life change and outreach and evangelism coming from that scenario. And then as I got a bit older, I was thinking, I don't even really have a testimony. Like I can't see necessarily the huge difference that Jesus has made in my life. I just, this is something I've always known. But now I'm just about turned 68 and I realize to be given a faith perspective as a child, to grow up in a Christian home, to become to faith at an early age, to take it seriously, that is about the biggest gift you can give anybody.
Yes, I
agree. And that is about the biggest testimony you can give anybody, because you actually don't end up with a lot of, I don't know, worldly stuff in your life that messes you up and gives you issues.
Right, like, bringing along some of that baggage that you inevitably pass down to your children, and not that we don't all have our own issues.
Yeah.
But I think what you said about your testimony is so relatable to so many of us who did grow up, you know, knowing the Lord, having a relationship with the Lord. And then you see other people who have these radical life changes, and they do, they have that testimony. And mm-hmm. so I can even think of times where I've been asked, you know, to share, and I was like, well, what do I have to, mm-hmm. you know, Jesus has just kind of always been by my side. Yeah. And it's been such a big part of my life, but I don't know that I have the, you know, the radical testimony. So I think there's so many people that can relate to that. But now I can look, and I so agree. I think of all the impact of anything that I've had on my boys, I would hope that it is giving them the gift of growing up in a Christian household that puts Jesus first.
And being loved. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, loving God first, obviously, and then loving others well without being consumed by your own junk.
Right.
I know we all have it, but to just sometimes I've seen so much trauma mm-hmm. and the effects that it has, and now I'm looking back and just feeling like, wow, the biggest gift you can give yeah. is to grow up in a Christian home.
Which is so interesting for you to say, because it's not like your journey has been an easy one. You know, it's not like, oh, I grew up a Christian and I've lived this just, you know, easy flow life. I mean, we're about to get into some difficult, hard times uh-huh. that I think one of the ways that you put it is that your faith journey, God led you through a journey that you didn't even know was possible. But now you see all the ways that it weaved into the whys and how it impacted the mm-hmm. character of each member of your family. Mm-hmm. And it's my favorite part of your story. But let's go back to, you were married at how young?
I was married at 20. 20? I met my husband at 16.
Okay, 16 years old, married at 20. He was a concert promoter, so you've kind of always been around.
He was in music. He became a concert promoter soon after, actually, really when Rebecca was born at 22, when I was 22, he became a concert promoter. He'd been in music, though, since he was 15, I think.
Okay.
And in those days, it's sort of the Peter, Paul and Mary era, the folk music, and he was in folk groups. And then he realized that he was a better manager than he was an artist. And so he slipped from, you know, being a performer into a management role and has sort of been in that role ever since.
Okay. Know. Okay. So you guys are in Australia. What part mm-hmm. of Australia did the kids grow
we,
up in?
We grew up, all the kids were born in Sydney, and except for our youngest, Libby, who was born here in America. And then after our sixth child was born, I have seven kids, after the sixth child was born, that's when our life sort of started to fall apart. Mm-hmm. And we moved then to Brisbane, and all our family moved from Sydney to Brisbane. And so Brisbane is now sort of our hometown if okay. we're going back to Australia.
Gotcha. Okay. So due to various circumstances, and again, all the details you can find in the book, it's called Behind the Lights, uh-huh. right? But to fast forward a little bit, you guys fall upon a situation where things start to fall apart. Financial situation is one that is rather grave. And you guys get on a plane, come to America with 16 suitcases, uh-huh. six children, and one on the way. Uh-huh. Take me back there.
Yeah, pretty dramatic. And I've realized since how many people can relate to having their worlds fall apart, either through job loss, you know, family, something happening in their family. But we had big financial pressures. David lost a quarter of $1 million probably in 1988, I think, on a tour in Australia. And he knew he wasn't going to trade out of that one. I mean, in concert promotion, you can cover the small losses, but once you get into a big loss like that, he knew this was dramatic. He had two other sort of avenues that he was thinking of turning to. He was actually the person who had realized the strength of praise and worship music in the church. And we were going to Hill CLC at the time. And he went to the pastor there and said, what about we record some of this new music that's coming out? And so he did the first two recordings for Hills, which is now Hillsong. And then
he was on the cutting edge of that whole movement that we're all benefiting from.
Yeah. The wow. praise and worship music, music movement. And then I think the pastors realized, gosh, this is something. And there was no contract. And so they, on David's 40th birthday, said, we don't need you anymore. And that was his sort of diversion to get out of our financial scenario, selling everything we had, maybe going into that avenue, and then that door closed. And then he had a third sort of place that he was hoping to go to, and that he was going to, we actually came to America to the possibility of coming and moving to Tulsa and working for Carmen. And Carmen, we had done very well with Carmen in Australia, and David had a proposal of setting up a record company for him and managing his concerts and stuff. And so we came over to the possibility of living there. And then in the March of 2000 and what a minute, 1991, so sorry, I'm going back. 1990 we went over to Tulsa, and then 1991, in March of 1991, Carmen said no. He didn't want it. He had bought our airfares to come. We had sold everything to come. So we were in a real place of what's next?
You were that close to this life-changing.
Yeah, we've had three doors close. We've sold our house. We've sold everything pretty much we own. We were about a month or so from coming to America anyway. And so it was really, that was a very, very hard season. That Easter of 1991 was just a devastating time for David. And he really regrouped and he came back and he said, do you think you'd be open to going to America if I found something else that I could do? And he came over in the June of 91, found another management job. And so we arrived in August of 91 with the 16 suitcases, with eight children, and me actually pregnant with our youngest daughter.
Tell me about those living circumstances for a while. You guys moved into
dramatic.
You moved into a rental house with no furniture, no bed for your children. Mm-hmm. What were those days like?
Well, at that point, when you've really come to the end of your tether in a way, like you don't know what else to do, you take one step. And I think that's really when you're really faced a big wall, you just take the one step that seems to be open before you. And that one step was, we moved to Nashville. We knew that that's where David's job was. We found a rental home. We had a base income at that point. We had no car, obviously. We did find a rental home, had no furniture. Apparently the owner of the house realized that I was pregnant and we had a bunch of kids. He left a single mattress for me. He said, I can't have a pregnant woman sleeping on the floor.
Oh,
he knew our dire straits, I think, in a way. Mm-hmm. We made beds out of clothes for the kids and just pretended we were camping. Kids are incredibly, we were 14 down to two at the time. Kids are incredibly adaptable. You know, you just, if you have a pretty positive attitude and you just treat it as a bit of an adventure, it's amazing how they kick in and they follow suit. You know, if you get overwhelmed, then everybody's going to be overwhelmed, you know. So right. It really does depend upon, I think, a lot on attitude. And I've always been a person who is looking for, I think, two things. One is glass is always half full. There's always something to be thankful for. Count your blessings. And secondly, look for God's hand because it's there. It's just sometimes we get so caught up in our own mind and in our own anxieties and what's going on, we forget to see it. And so if you see his hand guiding you, being there with you on that journey, which he promises us anyway, then you can pretty much face anything, I think. And so he did lead and guide us. Rebecca, our eldest, started to get some babysitting jobs. We started to clean houses. Daniel, who was 12 at the time, we started doing some raking lawns that first fall.
This would be you and the kids out in the neighborhood raking yards together. To earn money.
Money. To buy groceries, pretty much.
To buy groceries. One of the things I think is interesting, and you're so right, I do think a mother sets the tone.
She does.
For whether or not we're going to mope and complain and what are we going to do and create stress for the kids. Or has the positive attitude of, like you said, where can we find God? There's a purpose in our journey. Where can we find God's hand at work? But I do love that it doesn't sound like from reading the book, you also did not hide the situation that you were in. You felt like it was very important for the kids to contribute, to be aware of. You didn't try to sugarcoat the situation your family was in. No. It was important for them to know and understand.
Oh, yeah. And they really did. Daniel ended up getting a job working at a flea market. Every Saturday morning, he would probably get paid about $20 for that. Even down to Joel, who would have at the time been about seven, he would go around in those days, all the public phone boxes and try and find quarters. Everything mattered. Everything mattered. So, you know, if we were at the airport, he would run and find carts to push back into the thing and get the quarter. I think that, I don't think it happens anymore, but you used to be able to get, he would do that, or he would go to all the phone boxes and try and find. I remember one Sunday night we wanted to go to church and we didn't have enough, well, at this point we did have it, we were given a car, we didn't have enough money to put petrol or gas in the car, and he went round to all the couches and searched around the back of the couches and found $2 in coin. Wow. So he was the scavenger type, you know, looking for money wherever he could. Daniel and Rebecca, they did a lot of work, extra work for us, and those things made a difference, because 2 months after we got to Nashville, David actually lost the job that he had.
Oh, wow.
And so we were then thrown back again, another door closed, another now more hopeless scenario. We're on the other side of the world. Again, God's gracious, within a couple of months he'd picked up another management job. But, you know, we were throwing a lot of curveballs, and if we hadn't have been able to pull together, then I don't think it would have – we wouldn't have survived. By then, Rebecca, who then became Rebecca St. James, our oldest daughter, she had recorded an album back in Australia. David knew he needed to do that. So she'd recorded a praise and worship album back in Australia at the ripe old age of 14. And so when he came to America, he had that recording. And so he was going around to producers and record companies to see if anyone was interested in her. Mm-hmm. And so we had had dinner with a producer in town. And David, we talked about the family a lot. It was just David and me. They came and picked us up at the house, so they had to drop us off. And then David wanted them to meet the kids. So he invited them into the house, he and his wife, and they came in and they saw at that point we had a dining room table and four chairs, and we're a family of, what, eight? And then they saw no furniture. And we were... I think they would be surprised. Now I look back, I mean, I don't even know what we were thinking really. But they would have been surprised the fact that we were content and that the house was empty. There was nothing other than that dining room table and those four chairs.
Wow.
And so they went home and they're like, they would have been blown. I would have been shocked if I'd gone into someone's house. I mean, like anybody would be shocked.
Right.
And so they went home and they said, went to their Sunday school class and said, we need to look after these people. And so before we knew it, that following week, a couple of cars came. They walked through the house. I mean, it sort of, in a way, might have appeared rude because they were sort of looking to see what needs were there. So they walked through the house and then they went back. They spoke to their Sunday school class, and the next we knew. And none of this, we were asked, could they do it or anything? It was just their initiative.
You weren't seeking. Yes.
No, it was all their initiative. Mm-hmm. They rocked up with two box trucks of furniture. And then they just unloaded it all.
Do you remember that day so vividly?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. So crazy.
That's so,
so
special.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we were loved on very much by people in the local community. And those little things that for those guys probably didn't seem that much. It was just a family in need and they could meet a need. Mm-hmm. For us, it was God loving on us. And it was a miracle. Like it was, and the miracle of the car was another one. You know, the kids, and again, when we walk a journey together openly and honestly with each other, and sometimes vulnerably, a lot of times when our faith might be feeling a little overwhelmed because we're looking at the hopelessness of the scenario we're in, a lot of times it's kids who'll lead us.
So true. Yes, absolutely.
And so they were praying for a car. And so we arrived and got settled in our house in September of 91. In November of 91, we were invited, a couple of people who lived in our neighbourhood had started to learn about us and were driving by, and we were obviously known. We were the family with all the children. And so we were invited to a homeschooling Thanksgiving dinner. Australia doesn't have Thanksgiving, so this is all novelty. At that point, my parents had joined us over there for Christmas. David and Rebecca actually had a commitment back in Australia. Rebecca was in a wedding back in Australia, and they were in Australia at the time. And I get this phone call, and the guy says, I'd like to have you come and join us for this Thanksgiving dinner. You'd meet some people, and we'd like to meet you. And I said, well, there's nine of us. Actually, there's eight of us because David and Rebecca had gone and my parents were there. There's eight of us. We don't have any transport. You'd have to pick us up. And not everybody has transport for eight people.
Eight people, right.
And he said, oh, no, I've got a friend who's got a van. I'll come and pick you up. And that's no worries. So he picks us up, takes us over there. We meet a lot of nice people. Kids were pretty, you know, they enjoyed the whole night because there's lots of food and, you know, lots of fun. And I was getting tired at the end of the night and I was waiting and I said, I need to go home, but I can't just walk out the door and say thank you and get in a car. I've got to be waited to be chauffeured home.
Right.
And I couldn't find John, who's the guy who invited us and brought us there. I couldn't find him anywhere. And so I waited and I'm like, kids, you know, just settle. We're going to go home when I find him. Then I found him and I said, do you mind taking us home? The kids are tired. I'm tired. We just need to go. And he pushed up some keys and said, you can take yourself home. And I'm like, what? And he said, you can take yourself home. Here are the keys. And I'm like, no, I can't take the keys. And he said, why? And I said, because I found out from the neighbors next door that if I have an accident and crash a car, you're going to be financially responsible and you could lose everything. Mm. That man made a statement of faith that has to challenge every single one of us. He said, God's told me to give you this car, give you this van. And he said, if you crash that van and I'm held responsible and I lose everything, then that's God's will for me. Take the car.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, he understands the bottom line here. I mean, he understands the worst case scenario here, the commitment that he's making in giving us this car. And that was the start of our wheels two months after we got there. And that's a direct answer to prayer.
Absolutely. And your kids' prayers.
And our kids' prayers.
Which are so powerful.
So powerful.
Wow.
So believing that God would give us a car. Mm-hmm.
How would you say, looking back today, that these circumstances, and we're about to get to the good part of the story where everything starts getting a little bit sunnier, but how would you say that those circumstances affected and impacted who your kids are today?
Oh, hugely. Particularly the older ones. I was when we that first fall when we started raking leaves together, and we were quite the sight on the street we were living on was the main street into a neighborhood, so people were driving by our place, and to see six of us or whatever out the front, all sizes, raking leaves, people are friendly. They would stop and say, hey, guys, you're doing such a good job. You know, would you come down to our house? Then people would see us down there. And so I think we earned, doesn't sound a lot of money, but for us it was a lot of money. I think we earned $600 that fall. Raking leaves.
Wow.
Together as a family. And I realized in a lot of the jobs and as time went on, Rebecca was cleaning and some of the houses were so big that it would be Rebecca and me and one of the boys. You know, we were doing a lot of things together, that was the foundation for what God was wanting to do in the future, which is we work together. But instead of working together on, you know, raking, doing lawn care or gardening or cleaning houses, mm-hmm. we were actually working together to put on a concert, and the kids were learning skills, but they had learned how to work together doing those menial tasks where everybody mattered, everybody had a responsibility, everybody had to, you know, complete the task. And I think that so God uses everything mm-hmm. to teach us. And I don't think I would have ever thought about it
yeah.
had we not had that season where everybody was needed.
And that work ethic.
And the work ethic.
That they learned at such a young age too.
And I think they definitely saw the power of prayer, which Rebecca continued into her ministry. They definitely saw the impact, the importance of family. They definitely saw the impact of the miraculous and God answering prayer and the power. And I think that faith of doing things together, of praying together, of being together, it impacted every single one of them.
I'm sure. The other thing they saw is that God will provide.
Oh, yes.
He did it every time.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You've probably heard that if a woman over the age of 30 is going to add one thing to their skincare regimen, it needs to be vitamin C. I use the Barefaced Liquid Gold Vitamin C Serum morning and night, and it protects my skin and helps promote collagen, which we all need. I pair it with another one of my favorite Barefaced products, the Tinted SPF, which is formulated with iron oxides that help prevent future dark spots from forming. It's a sheer tint with a glowy finish, and it feels so good on my skin. Together, these two products are the perfect combo as we head into summer, and you can get 15% off your purchase when you use the code MAMA15 at barefaced.com. I was just in Abel's Nashville flagship store, and the new spring line of clothing, leather bags, and jewelry is all fabulous. Abel is a global fashion brand focused on empowering women, both the women who make their products and the women who wear them. You're going to love these high-quality, gorgeous pieces. And here's the best part. Got it from my mama listeners. Get 20% off their first purchase site-wide with code MAMA20 when you visit ableclothing.com. Remember, every purchase provides an opportunity for change. So we'll fast forward for time's sake, and Rebecca's career gets going. She's impacting so many, and she's traveling. This truly was a family affair for you guys, right?
Yeah. She did the first tour with David on her own, and she was a support act for – she was signed at 16. I think of God album – Rebecca St. James was the first album, and it came out, I think in 1994. And then she did a first tour or so, support tour with just David going, and David was managing her. And then when we realized that David wanted to sort of be on the road more, he wanted to reduce expenses because he needed to trade in the black, really, at the end of the day. We had nothing, we had to. We couldn't afford any losses. So that's when he realized to train the family and to go together. We'd also realized by that point we had done so much life very closely together that we didn't want to be separated, that there was, we actually found great comfort in being together. And so
what was everyone's job?
Okay, so Rebecca obviously was the artist. Daniel, who's 2 years young, they're sort of 2 years down, he did the lights. The lights. He went and did a course, and she was showing how to set up all the lights. Ben, who was a couple of years under, we brought a cousin over the same age as Rebecca, who was about 18, and he and Ben set up the sound. David ran the sound, and then it sort of went down. Joel and Luke underneath that were, I think Luke was a spotlight operator, and I think Joel helped Daniel set up the lights.
So tell me a little bit about Joel and Luke. I found this part of, as a fan of For King and Country, a little bit interesting. Joel actually wanted to pursue a solo career. He was very musically talented. And what more in the secular world, right? He was going to kind of be the next.
He wanted to be Justin, different to Rebecca.
The next Justin Timberlake, right?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's it. You've got it. He did want to be the next Justin, though. I think Justin Timberlake was probably around at the time. So that's where I think there were quite a few solo male artists. Joel had come to David when he was 16 and said, I feel like God's calling me into music. I don't want to be necessarily in Christian music. I would prefer to be, I feel like I want to be different. And
wanted to do his own thing.
Want to do my thing. I don't want to be compared to Rebecca. And so David listened and said, okay, go. I'll put up some writing opportunities for you and go write and come back and let's see what it sounds like. So he went and wrote. I don't think David was super enamored with anything that really came back. So they wrote more, you know. And then he put Joel and actually with Daniel, his oldest brother, as a duo, as a support act for Rebecca. That lasted for probably don't know, maybe half a tour. I don't even think it lasted the whole tour. And there was very little, it just didn't gel. Mm-hmm. And so David again sort of said, no, not
this isn't it.
Not working yet. And then as time went on and Joel was doing background vocals for Rebecca, he started at 12. Luke had left school. Luke did some background vocals while he was running lights from the lighting board, not from the stage. And David went to Joel and said, if you really want to pursue music, when you're doing solo, you are, you're coming against the best in the world and you're just competing with the best in the world. Like, there are so many male artists out there. And he said, you know, I think it'd be better if you were to go do it with your brother, because then you're a duo.
And there wasn't a lot of that at the time.
There wasn't a lot of duos. Right. And there's really even now, lot of duos.
So true.
And so he said, and you have that family familiarity of voice that would be great. And he said, you'll be unique if you do that. And Joel, I think that the kids have all understood that their father knows a lot and has great instinct.
Respect his opinion.
So he's like, okay. But it was really like carrying a burden, like, come on, Luke, we're doing this.
A little bit begrudgingly.
Yeah. They were never close, really, growing up.
And quite opposite, you talk mm-hmm, about. Mm-hmm. They were very opposite in personality, and mm-hmm. or they are.
They still are, yeah. Uh-huh. Joel is impetuous. He's more emotional. He has great charisma. He's a lovely personality, like just so attractively. He just makes you feel very warm and special. And Luke has a much more, he's laid back, he's quieter, he's a deeper thinker. He's steady and calm.
Which is probably good for Joel's personality, right?
It's very good.
A nice balance.
So I think in a way, opposites attract often in marriage. You know, here we've got a perfect marriage of a duo. We've got two very different personalities, very different skills. It took a long while for them to gel, to become one, and as well as it took a long while for Joel to recognize what Luke brought to the table. Mm. For a long while there, he saw Luke's deficits more so than Luke's positives. And so now there is very strong mutual respect and love. Mm-hmm. Now they're very close. Now they understand what each brings to the table and they respect the other's boundaries, if you know what I mean. Like, this is what you're good at, so, you know, you go do that.
You do that, right.
You know.
You said there was kind of a turning point when there was a situation where Luke's had some health problems over the years, to where Joel was kind of forced into doing a show by himself without his brother. And that might have been for the best, mm-hmm. because it seemed to change Joel's perspective on how much he needed his brother in his life.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how God often brings hard circumstances. Well, I think he probably always does. Hard circumstances into our life to either refine us or to teach us something or to change a course of direction. Mm. And Joel had always wanted to do a solo career. He felt, in a way, burdened by having to do it with Luke, recognized some of Luke's skills, what he brought to the table, but really didn't accept him totally. Until Luke got sick, and by this time they had a record deal. By this time they had, I think, their first album out. And Luke got sick and had to leave the road for 3 months. Luke is 6'4". At that point he was down to 129 pounds with digestive issues, and he was too weak to even hold his six-month-old baby. You know, so he had to come off the road. He had to get his health back in order. So Joel is a generous, loving chap, and he was like, I'll do it. You just rest, you just get yourself better. And then he had a scenario that was really an eye-opener to all of us, where I'm over actually at Luke's house helping care for him because his wife had a little six-month-old baby, and she was feeling the pressure of the baby and Luke. For King Country was playing for a Greg Laurie crusade, mm-hmm. and there were 33,000 people in the Angels Stadium. And in a way, I think Joel realized this is what I've always wanted. Like, I've wanted to be out there doing this, but on my own and whatever. And he realized, oh, he calls his brother up before he goes on. Yeah, and it's surreal because Luke is actually able to sit on his couch at home and watch via live stream on TV what is going on. So this is the first time Luke has seen the band perform without him. And so Joel calls him up before and says, hey, you know, we're here, we're going to do, this is the order of the day, this is how we're going to manage it, this is who's singing what or how we're doing it. And he's like, you know, I'm glad you've been able to watch and see what we're doing. I hope you like it. But, you know, it's a big stage to be there all on your own. Said, you just need to keep getting better because I don't want to do this. And it was a moment of turning point of realizing he actually, I think, said, I do all my moves sort of in the first song. I've got nobody to work off. And I said, it's much harder. You know, and so he then learned to appreciate exactly what Luke, you know, the partnership that they had. And Luke, you know, we're all watching at home. Luke's seeing it, and then as soon as Joel leaves the stage and he's driving, he calls him back again and says, what do you think? And in that moment, I think Joel, one, realised he didn't want to do it on his own, how much Luke had brought to the table. And Luke felt needed and wanted, whereas before it was sort of like, you know. And Luke, sensitive chap, like he knew that his brother was sort of not real keen for him to be a part of this.
Right.
Whereas now Luke realized more of what he was bringing to the table of where he steps in, and he was getting more confident. And I would say now it is really the perfect marriage. Like it really, they know what each other really does bring. They respect each other and they love each other.
I think that it's so interesting for us as for King and Country fans to see the relationship of the brothers. Is quite normal for a brotherly relationship to kind of have to figure out how do your strengths complement mine, and we might be different and we might butt heads a little bit, but together, you know, we make a pretty great team. And the way God used that experience to open both of their eyes to Luke feeling more valued.
Yeah.
And maybe Joel even appreciating Luke a little bit more. But as a fan, to look at them and go, you know what? At the end of the day, those are just two pretty typical brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Two really talented brothers. And I mean,
when Rebecca was around and Rebecca, the little kids, Josh and Libby and David and I would travel in an RV, and sometimes the boys would go on a bus or in the band's RV, whatever. But they would be there for us to set up, and then we might rock up at like 3 and we'd walk in and the volunteers that were there we'll be leaving as we're rocking up, and they'd be like, oh, so you guys are the parents. You can tell they're brothers the way they talk to
the way they talk to each other. I'm sure.
And, you know, it was sort of always like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, so yes. Wait,
do we need to go in and break up the little squabble going on here? Oh, I think I've been there, done that. And I love that you guys did the RV, because that has been a fun thing as you and I were talking about.
Yeah.
Doing the RV thing. You said, been there, done that.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit about the book and the movie, because, you know, it's one of those things where your story is so incredible and you think, man, somebody should write a book or make a movie about that. And both are actually happening. The book is out and available. It's such a great story, and it goes so much deeper than you and I are able to today. But tell me how the movie came to be and how you're feeling about it.
Yeah, pretty interesting. We actually had, why the book actually came into being was we were doing a documentary on our story. And it was in telling some of the stories, because not many people ask in depth about your story.
Right.
And in telling some of the story, I had a couple people come in a short space of time and say, gosh, you need to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, God changed some switch in me. And I'm like, yeah, it's time.
Is there a you that 10, 15 years ago would not have been open to that?
Probably, yeah. I don't like the limelight very much. Mm-hmm. I like being behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I'm much more a supporter than a front person. It's pushing me to be more front, and I do know marketing and promotion and how, you know, getting stuff out there is going to get you out there,
right?
You know, and I'm not super keen on it, but I'm super keen on following what God wants to. Obedience is better than sacrifice, and if he asks obedience, if this is his will, then I will move forward in confidence. And I at that point, that switch changed and I recognized that God did want this and that the timing was now. And I went back into my husband and I said, David, I want to write the book. And he's like, you what? And I'm like, yeah, you need to find me someone to publish the book. And he's like, okay. I think a lot of people have recognized when we did the documentary too. So I recognized the book needed to come out mm-hmm. and that I needed to write it and it needed to be a memoir, which means then the family did not have any say in what I'm writing.
I was about to say, I definitely want to go there. How much input did the kids have in this book?
They really didn't have any, to tell you the truth. I just sat down with a co-writer and just told my story. And then she went away and organized it and whatever. But at one point I turned to her and I felt a little vulnerable because I'm actually telling the beginnings of Rebecca's career,
yes,
of where that went, and then the beginnings of For King Countries. And I felt – and I'm honest. I mean, like I'm honest and I'm vulnerable.
Yes,
and I'm like,
yes,
this is going to be really weird because it's about them. And so I got a nervous moment and I went to the co-writer and I said, do you really think I should just like – have the kids read their little bits just so that I can, you know, figure out whether or – and she's like, no, you change it. As soon as – it's not your memoir after that. They're free to write their own books. They're free to even go against what you say if necessary, you know. But this is your memoir. This is from your perspective. And I felt she was right. So the kids felt very vulnerable when they got that copy in their hands.
What was the feedback you got from the kids?
I don't think some have read it.
Really?
And we're talking, you know, just on a year later.
Oh.
I don't think they've read it. Not all of them have read it from cover to cover. I'm sure they've glanced through.
They looked for their name.
And read bits and pieces. I really only know of two sons and their wives have read it. Oh, three.
Do you think they're hesitant too about knowing details of
probably
how you shared some of it?
Yeah. So Ben, our videographer and storyteller, said, I'm intrigued about the stories you included and the stories you didn't.
Oh.
So he obviously had a different perspective.
Uh-huh.
I know I included the stories that said something to me about God's dealing with us.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Where, yeah, I could see the spiritual principles, or I could see this was coming from him, you know, or could point back to him.
Because that was your purpose in sharing your
that
story.
That was the purpose
in sharing. It wasn't for fame or entertainment.
At one point, our youngest daughter, Libby, has walked a very different journey because she's had chronic disease. And I said to – so I, she had her own chapter. And I said when I had people coming up to me, I said, Libby, I don't know if you've read your chapter or not, but I suggest you probably do.
You may want to know.
You may want to know what's in there because other people are, you know.
And you were very vulnerable about Libby,
yes,
and her path being different.
Yes.
Yes.
And so she did read it. And I was, again, I think she's only read her little part.
She found the chapter called Libby.
That's it. And she came away and I was touched because she said, I actually, looking at it through your perspective, has given me some healing.
Oh, wow. Again, purpose behind God pushing you to take that out of the box for you step. That's pretty incredible.
So it was, you know, I probably have had no expectation of what the kids necessarily think. I think some, as I say, I'm not sure everybody's still read it. I think Rebecca came to me at one point and said, I just don't have the emotional bandwidth to go there.
Wow.
And I get it. I think
that reminds you of how difficult some of those parts of the story were for them.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and it speaks into the meager times where they were very real for the kids as well.
Very real. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have no expectations. It's there. They know I love them.
So now the tables are flipped a little bit because there's a movie being made,
yeah,
about basically your storyline, but it's not necessarily the perspective that you shared.
Yeah.
So now you get to be a little bit nervous about what someone's writing. Tell us about the movie.
So again, probably from the documentary, we recognize that the book needed to happen and then a movie, that it needed to be dramatized.
But a screenplay writer, like a professional, mm-hmm, took your story, mm-hmm, without a whole lot of input from, mm-hmm, you and David.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no wonder you're nervous.
So eventually, Joel ended up partnering with him.
Okay.
And so they went through the script again. Joel added more familiarity sort of scenarios into it. They changed a fair amount of it. They added more depth. And I think a few other people maybe had read it. I think Luke might have read it. Ben might have read it. So there were people. And then in the end, I'm like, are we ever going to read it? Like, I mean, I know it's about Dave and me, but are we ever going to read it?
Are they giving you a taste of your own medicine?
I think so. I think it might be payback. Obviously, it's a dramatization. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not, I mean, it's not exactly true, but I think the sentiments are there.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably questioned a couple of things. You've got to let go some of the more. So they what I realized in movies, which I did not know before, you've got to have a protagonist and an antagonist. And so they were looking at who was going to be the protagonist and who was going to be the antagonist, and it was, you know, thrown around as to different people. In the end, Dave, I'm become the protagonist, so I look better than I really am. And then David had to be the antagonist, so he actually is angrier. So I think what they've done with David is feelings that he had probably internally, they've actually made more visual.
Interesting.
So the feelings of defeat, the feelings of being overwhelmed, probably at times the feelings of anger at things being taken from him.
Right.
Are shown more externally in the movie, where I'm sure he felt a lot of that internally.
Mm-hmm.
But as
but
leader
because
of the
it's
home,
a movie,
yeah, it has
you know,
to, it
you
has
need
to,
a
yeah.
little bit to amp up maybe some of the drama of
some
that.
Some of the drama of that.
But it wasn't that the feelings weren't there. Mm-hmm. Right.
So David's watched the first half an hour a couple of times. We have not sat down and watched the whole movie. I think that is coming up. They wanted to get it to a certain place, and then they're going to have a family viewing to see. It sounds like a funeral, but they're going to have a family viewing of the movie to just see how we all respond to it. Joel did say to me about a week ago that when the movie's being played, he's going to sit in a chair and just watch David and me. I'm like, oh, gosh, just... Yeah. So I'm very intimidated at this point.
He's preparing you a little bit, I think. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so it's
interesting.
Tell
me about Joel.
David's cried both times.
Oh,
he has seen the first half an hour.
Well, there's no way it's not a special story.
I think it's going to be very – I think – and he said the second time he noticed a whole much more depth of even how they'd captured more of his character, because the thing that people may not know is Joel actually plays David.
Yes, that was what I wanted to ask you about. What is that like as a – well, you haven't seen it.
No.
You haven't seen any scenes
I've seen the
where,
trailer.
The trailer where Joel plays your husband.
I was on set a few times as well because all the characters who played the family members wanted to meet the family.
Oh, wow.
So we were on set quite a few times.
You didn't get to have any say in who plays you?
Mm-mm.
None.
Mm-mm.
And how odd is it for you to see your son play your husband?
He actually does a very good job. He does understand his father very well. He has a lot of personality traits like his father, so they tend to butt heads a little. And probably Luke is a little more like me.
Mm-hmm.
But
I was about to ask you, because I love to ask the moms with the name of the podcast, what did your kids get from their mama? So that's kind of answering that. Would you say Luke, of the seven children, is most like you?
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
And Joel's most like his dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rebecca's got a bit of a mix. She's a bit like David, a bit like me. Sitting back at this age, so David has this saying that he often says, he says, oh, I wish I had your youth, you know, when he's talking to people. I'm thinking, I don't want to go back at all. Like, I'm very content to sit in this age watching kids doing what they're doing, raising kids. We have 14 grandchildren. Just seeing the legacy that's being passed on, supporting them, particularly in prayer. I think to any mamas out there, I recognize the power of prayer in our own lives. But both David and I are generational Christians. Both David had a very committed family, grew up in the church like I did. His father, instead of being a preacher, was a lay preacher, was a bank manager by career. And as we got older and the families, you know, their children were married, my parents' children were married, they took up the passion, really, of praying for their children and their grandchildren. And I knew that prayer covering. I've known it and felt it again and again from both David's parents as well as my parents. We would have traveled in that RV. Oh my goodness. We traveled. We've done every crisscross road there is for the 10 years. I think we probably had RVs. There were a couple of incidents that were pretty scary, that could have been scary. And I know the protection of God on that RV. And I know it came from our parents' commitment to prayer. So being at this age, seeing our kids, six of the seven are married, we've got 14 grandchildren, the best thing I can do, or the best thing David and I can do for our children, is to pray for them. And so every night at about 9 o'clock, David and I go to our bedroom, we talk about our day, and we pray together. And I just know that that will make a huge difference in our children and grandchildren as time goes on. And I love being in this season where I'm not actively doing it, but I am actively bringing them before God. And that's the legacy that's been passed down, and I want to pass that on and pray for them as God's leading them on their lives.
Visit us at our Instagram page at Got It From My Mama and let us know what you think of this episode and the Smallbone family's journey. They are pretty incredible. We would love for you to subscribe and follow our podcast so you don't miss an interview with these inspiring mamas. See you back here next week.